Well, after taking off for a couple of months at least, I actually didn't keep track of when we started, but taking off at least a couple of months on a kind of on another study, we're back into the Minor Prophets. We're halfway through. We have six of the Minor Prophets to go through, and we're going to start looking at Nahum tonight. If you have your Bibles, you might want to open to Nahum. And I'm going to try, I can't promise you that I'm going to be good at this, but I'm going to try and kind of have a kind of a question and answer sheet, not just as an introduction, but kind of lead us a little bit through Nahum. And so that's what this is. We're not going to go, obviously, then go through all of this tonight. First of all, we come to the name Nahum. If you look at verse 1, it says, "The Oracle of Nineveh, the Book of the Vision of Nahum the Elkoshite." And we have this man by the name of Nahum. His name is actually the word meaning to comfort or console. Comfort or console. And so that's answer to question number one. Now we're going to have to deal with another question that I have tied to that, because I think there's significance in his name in this context here, and that is, for whom then was this Nahum? And that's supposed to be a small letter N in this context. For whom was this Nahum, this comfort or consolation? For whom was this intended? Well, what we're going to see here is we're going to go through this. It's intended for Judah. It's a comfort for them. And it's a comfort for them because his oracle or his burden is with regard to Nineveh. And by issuing this against Nineveh, it's going to be a comfort to Judah. Well, if you have an enemy that's constantly breathing threats at you, and somebody tells you that they're going to take that enemy out and eliminate them, that would be a relief. That would be a comfort. Okay? So it's with regard, so this is intended for Judah. We are going to explain why it's for Judah in the next statement here, because it tells us in what century did Nahum prophesy. Prophesied in the 7th century. 7th century B.C., yes. Now, we ask a question here that we want to have two reasons why we know this. Okay? Reason number one. I don't care what order you put these in, but reason number one is, verse 1 tells us that this is an oracle or a burden. We're going to talk about that word in a little while. An oracle or a burden with regard to Nineveh. If you look down again in verse 8 of chapter 2, Nahum 2:8, it says, "Though Nineveh was like a pool of waters throughout her days, now they are fleeing." And so he's looking forward to this. He's looking forward to this future judgment that God is going to bring upon the city of Nineveh. And so this has to be, number one, this has to be before the destruction of Nineveh. And Nineveh is destroyed. Well, we should say it falls to the Medes and the Babylonians or Chaldeans in 612 BC. Okay, so it has to be written before that, because it's not telling about what happened after the fact. It's prophesying about what's going to happen to it before the fall of Nineveh. Okay. Now the other thing is, if you look in chapter 3, look in chapter 3 and look at verse 8. It says, "Are you better than," and this is the way the New American Standard reads, "than Noaman, which was situated by the waters of the Nile." Now, if you have a New American Standard, they have a marginal note there that says it's the city of Ammon, that is Thebes. Thebes is what we usually know it as. This is 3:8. Nahum 3:8. So this is after the fall of Thebes, or the fall of Noaman, which also is a notable date in history. And it fell in 663. So that tells us that Nahum is prophesying somewhere in that window of about 50 years between 663 and 612 BC. So we'd say the last half, he's prophesying in the last half of the 7th century. okay, is where he's at. So he's in sometime in the last half of the 7th century, roughly. Any questions on those opening questions that we have here? Okay. Now, going back to verse 1, you can see quite plainly, it says that it is the oracle or the burden of Nineveh. So when we're talking about who is Nahum's prophecy against, not who is the comfort for, but who's the prophecy against? Nineveh. Okay. So that one's an easy one. But now what empire, and this isn't really spoken of in the book, but we're going to talk about this just briefly. What empire was Nineveh the capital of? Or of what empire was Nineveh the capital, to speak in better English? Assyria. Okay. The Garniks have two boys that go both by the names of the Assyrians. Aram, they were the Arameans. Okay, Aram. And Asher. Asher is actually the name for Assyria. Okay. So, they, of course, their boys are actually named by other people, not by, they didn't name them after Assyrians. It's just, but it is interesting that those are, it's shared in that way. So we have Ashur and Aram. In fact, a lot of times when you have Assyria, sometimes, and when I'm going through it in the Hebrew, sometimes Assyria is Ashur, and sometimes it's Assyria in your New American Standard, it's Aram, okay, the Arameans. And I gave you a little map here, and just to kind of give you a little bit of reference to this stuff, it's a lot easier, I think, than trying to have you turn to a Bible in the back. I want you to try to locate, and it might help then if you have a pen to circle or underline or something, draw an arrow at so you can see where these at, these different areas, okay? And I'm sorry, I should have found a black and white one that didn't have any color. But, well, I have to leave room for the other notes out here, okay? Up in the right-hand corner, just a little ways over, maybe an inch over, three quarters of an inch over, is the city of Nineveh. Yeah. And where am I? Right there. There's Nineveh. Okay. Mark it, circle it. I've got mine circled. Okay. There's Nineveh. Okay. Then if you go almost straight south of Nineveh, you're going to find Babylon. Okay. That's where Babylon, the city of the Babylonians or the Chaldeans. And that's, go almost straight south of Nineveh. Just keep going south and eventually you'll find Babylon. Almost straight south. A little bit to the right, but or to the east.
I'm
okay. Hold your map up here and I'll point to it for you. It's right there. Maybe I should just have you look at it in the back of your Bible, but I thought it was just... Okay.
Okay.
Now, boy, this is fun, isn't it? Okay. Just think what you have to look forward to. Be glad you still have good eyes. Okay. And then the last one down here is Nineveh up here, then Babylon, then come all the way over into Egypt. And this one's going to be easier because it's almost to the bottom of the map under the word kingdom, under the M on your map, and it's the city Thebes down on the Nile. That's the city Noaman. It's not called Thebes in your Bible. It's Noaman, which actually is the name of an Egyptian god. Okay. Noaman is literally the city of Ammon, and Ammon was their god that was equivalent to, take other gods, Baal, Syria, or the Phoenician god of thunder, and across North Africa, Zeus, the Greek god of thunder, Jupiter, the Roman god of thunder, and if you're a Norsky like me, Thor, the Norse god of thunder. I mean, isn't it interesting? They all had this god of thunder, and they're all really talking about the same guy, and that's who this Ammon was, and that's what Thebes was named after, down there, was named after. And that was always in their culture. That was normally their chief god in most of those cultures. Okay.
So and Ammon and Thor and Zeus, and what was
Baal. And they're all gods in those different cultures. They're chief god in all these cultures, and they're all just variations on the same character in these different religions that come out of here. It's interesting. You got all these religions, but in reality, all these throughout the Middle East and on up into Europe, they all are sharing some gods in common. Okay, they just gave them different names, and then they move around. And then in the middle, there's Judah. So I'm just trying to help you see where these things are with respect to Judah. Now I want you to notice also, if you can kind of look on the map, you have Judah, which is kind of that lighter colored area that's underneath the name Judah. And notice to the north, you don't have Israel anymore. Because at the time that we're looking at here, the north is gone. Okay, the north was taken away by the Assyrians, the people of Nineveh, but the Assyrians in general was taken away in 722. So at the time that Nahum is writing, Assyria or Israel has been gone for, at this time, 60 to 100 years, depending on when Nahum is writing. Okay, they've been gone. And at this time, now we have a threat by Assyria against Judah, which hopefully we'll get a look at here in just a minute. Okay. Now, you also look at your Bibles then again, and let's talk a little bit about this word in verse 1. It says the Oracle of Nineveh. And if you have a good New American...
Okay, sorry. Israel's been
gone for how long? Oh, 60 to 100 years. Okay.
722 BC.
And Thebes, remember, falls in 663. So you got about. No, that's the Babylonian captivity. This is Assyria. Okay. Okay. Here, let's just. It's not bad to kind of have a timeline to hang things on. Okay. So we have this. We have Abraham. Here's Abe, 2000 BC, roughly. Here's Sinai, and here's Moses. This is about 1500. We have David, roughly 1000 BC. Okay. And then we come up here. Let's mark it off. The cross here is about 500. And it's 586 that Judah goes to the Babylonian captivity. And in roughly halfway in between, there's 722 that Israel goes into Assyrian captivity. Okay? So it kind of gives you a kind of a timeline. So 2000, 1500, 1000, roughly halfway in here, we have 722. We have Israel goes away, and then 586. Okay. So what is that? 140 some years between these two falls. Okay. Now, this actually is not a bad question to ask about how this is related, because 586. The deportation, there were actually three deportations of people of Judah to Babylon. Daniel probably goes in the first one when they take away the young people and some of the bright people and such, and some of the royalty and such, they take them over there. Because Nebuchadnezzar's smart. Why not take the smartest people of that kingdom and bring them over here? Stop and think about it. Anybody that was involved in NASA and the space program here in the United States say we are actually in debt to German scientists that defected to us or agreed to come over after the war and not be prosecuted. and that's why we won the space race, quite seriously. It's because we inherited a lot of German brain power over here. And anyway, so that's what he did. And that actually started in 605. So we have deportations going from 605 to 586 in here. Nineveh is going to fall in 6. If Nineveh will fall, I'm going to put this down here in 612, and it falls to a confederacy of the Babylonians and the Medes. Okay.
You've heard of Darius the Mede. You've heard of the Medo. Can't read this? Okay. You've heard of the Babylonians. You've heard of Darius the Mede. The Medo-Persians, they ended up conquering the Babylonians eventually, and that happened to Daniel. But the Babylonian and Median Confederacy actually took down Nineveh in 612. So that was what allowed them to ascend to power. So now they are the ones, well, Babylon especially, that operates without contest throughout that region, which allows them eventually to come over and come against Judah, against Jerusalem. Okay, but that's another set of studies down the road in the other minor prophets that we'll get to before we're done. But not that won't be part of our study. We're looking at this time leading up to this fall of Nineveh. This is the fall of Nineveh. Okay, so I thought about giving you a timeline on here. And after writing this and misspelling Nineveh, it's N-I-N-E-V-E-H, because I just kept trying to put an A in there, because we say Nineveh. You got two E's, you don't pronounce them both the same. So, okay, now, here we go. Verse 1, we were talking about this word oracle, okay, or burden. If you have a New American Standard in the margin, they'll have the word burden. And it was interesting in reading on this, because it's translated in the NASB Oracle. I had this question. In fact, when I first started working on my notes, I kind of went with the English on this, and then I kind of was looking at the word, going back and forth, and I was looking at it, thinking, well, the word actually has the idea of a weight to it. When I was looking at it, I was going, so why do they translate it oracle? Well, actually, an oracle is a development of modern Bible students that look at this word that used to be translated burden in your old Bibles, and they've translated oracle because they say Nahum wasn't burdened. Did he shoulder a burden? And I was looking at them, I was going, well, no, he's not shouldering a burden. It's a burden that's given to him to throw on Nineveh. It's a burden that they bear. It's a weight of guilt on Nineveh, not on Nahum. And you have places where the prophet has the burden upon him because he's putting it upon somebody else. In other words, if I give Gary something to carry with him to his house, he's going to have to carry that burden until he gets to the house. Even though it's not for him to carry. That's not the purpose of it, for him to carry. So you get the idea when he's talking about burden. And as a result of it, I think burden is a better way to understand this word. It's more in keeping with the Hebrew background. So when we're talking about this idea of an oracle, I think that we ought to understand that this is a weight. And it's a weight that the Assyrians bear because of their unrighteousness. Nineveh is the target of that because Nineveh is the center of their city. Or the center of their government. Okay. Now, let's take a look at a few verses, and let's see if we can see something about the character of these people of Nineveh or Assyria. So if you look at 1:2, chapter 1 and verse 2, it says, "A jealous and avenging God is the Lord. The Lord is avenging and wrathful. The Lord takes vengeance on his adversaries. He reserves wrath for his enemies." So what are two things you could say out of verse 2 are true of Nineveh or Assyria? They're his adversaries and his enemies. Okay? Very simple. They were adversaries and enemies of God. And like I said, hopefully before the evening's over, we'll demonstrate a little bit of how they actually position themselves against God. Okay? And we'll see that. Look down in verse 8 again. Where we have this repeated, it said, "But with an overflowing flood, he will make a complete end of its site or its location. He will pursue his enemies into darkness." So again, he looks at them as enemies. Okay. Look over in chapter 3 in verse 1. Chapter 3 in verse 1. What does he say in chapter 3 in verse 1? "Woe to the bloody city, completely full of lies and pillage. His prey never departs."
So what are some things you could say there? It's a
violent city.
It's a bloody city. And it's a dishonest city. Okay. Which we'll talk a little bit more when we kind of work our way through this in a little bit more detail about the idea of lies. But one of the things that Assyria, and generally, if you've paid any attention to world history when you were growing up and you took world history, whether in school or when you were in college or whatever it is, one of the things that stands out about nations is nations are notorious for making treaties or agreements and breaking them. In other words, they're dishonest, but some more so than others. Every nation does it, but some are definitely a lot more guilty of it than other nations are. Okay. And that's what you have here. Okay. You have a city when it says full of lies and then it talks about pillage. What we'll look at when we come to this is I think part of the idea of lies and pillage has to do with the fact that they made certain promises to Israel and to Judah at different times, and then they'd take from what they did, and they'd run off and wouldn't provide any of the help that was asked or requested, which served Israel and Judah right for turning to Assyria in the first place for help. Why would you turn to an enemy of God? Okay. Any questions on that? Okay. Now, this should be an easy one. Don't any of you adults blurt this out. Okay, I don't want any adults to answer this question. Any of you kids, can you tell me what other prophet was sent to Nineveh?
Jonah.
That's right. Jonah was sent. Remember, what was Jonah? What did Jonah mean? Jonah meant dove. What did he do? What did Jonah do? He took flight. That's the way we learn Jonah in Hebrew. Jonah was the word for dove. And he took flight and basically tried to run off. Now, how long before Nahum was Jonah sent to Nineveh? Okay. We actually could. About 100 years, yeah. And we know that 2 Kings 14:25 tells us. Approximately in the rain, or at least some of the limits, because we don't know when you read the book of Jonah exactly when it transpired. But if you read 2 Kings chapter 14, and verse 25, we're going to go to verse 23. It says, in the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, became king in Samaria. Samaria is the north. Okay, it's the 10 tribes in the north that we call Israel. And reigned 41 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin. He restored the border of Israel from the entrance of Hamath as far as the Sea of Arabah. That is, he extended its border again. In other words, some of the border had been lost, just like, you know, they have border issues even in Israel today where they're contested by different countries. And so the border, you shift it over here and then you shift it over here. Well, that's what was going on there. You had the shifting. He restores it as far as that, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke through his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, who was of Gath-Hepher. So we know that Jonah either prophesied during the time that Jeroboam, and this is Jeroboam the second, not Jeroboam the first, but Jeroboam the second, some either during his reign or prior to it. Okay, most people think it's during his reign, although we have no proof conclusively one way or another. But it makes sense that it would have been during his reign if it was accomplished during his reign. Okay. So it's about 100 years earlier, because chronologically, and if you guys still have this, I'm still using this, but I passed these out when we started through the Minor Prophets. I don't have any extras with me tonight, but you can look on there and you can see roughly when Nahum's prophesying, when John Whitcomb thinks that Jonah's prophesying and in whose reign, and you can kind of compare those and roughly get the dates. Okay? Now, Now I get down to kind of the heart of the issue, what's going on in this book, and if you flip back to the book of Nahum a second. Actually, we're not going to Nahum, we're going to Isaiah. I'm sorry, I should look down at my notes first. Turn to Isaiah 10. Look before you speak, just like look before you leap. Huh? Isaiah 10, we want to look a little bit at how God had used Assyria, or in the context here, Aram, in the past. How had he used them in the past? And so we have Isaiah 10, if you look in Isaiah 10, look with me beginning in verse 5, and I'm going to read down through verse 15, and then we'll kind of touch on a couple of things. It says, "Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in whose hand is my indignation or my wrath or my fury. I send it against a godless nation, commission it against the people of my fury, to capture booty and to seize plunder, to trample them down like mud in the streets. Yet it does not so intend, nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather it is its purpose to destroy and to cut off many nations. For it says, are not my princes all kings? Is not Calno like Carchemish, or Hamath like Arpad, or Samaria like Damascus?" So it's comparing these different places and different situations that they had. "As my hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her images, just as I have done to Samaria and her idols? So it will be that when the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, that he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. For he has said, by the power of my hand and by my wisdom I did." And the New American Standard adds this. "For I have understanding, and I removed the boundaries of the peoples and plundered their treasures. And like a mighty man, I brought down their inhabitants. And my hand reached to the riches of peoples like a nest. And as one gathers abandoned eggs, I gathered all the earth. And there was not one that flapped its wing or opened its beak or chirped. Is the axe to boast itself over the one who chops with it? Is the saw to exalt itself over the one who wields it? Like a club wielding those who lift it, or like a rod lifting him that is not wood. Therefore the Lord of hosts, the God of hosts, will send a wasting disease among his stout warriors," and so on. But here's the point that we're trying to look at. God had used, verse 5, Assyria as a rod of his anger. And in verse 6, he had sent it against a godless nation. So in simple terms, God had used, and you see it again down in what he says in verse 9, verse 10, verse 11, how he was punishing Jerusalem and Samaria. He had used Assyria to punish a godless nation. What's a godless nation?
Israel
and Judah. Isn't that interesting, calling them a godless nation? They're a godless nation because they were doing what, according to verse 10? They were a kingdom of idols with graven images. Are those gods? No, those aren't gods. So that's why he calls it a godless nation. They were turning to things that are not God. He says that elsewhere in the book of Isaiah. Why do you turn to that which is not a god? And even, I love that. Isaiah is the one that's got that wonderful illustration of a man that takes a piece of wood and cuts it and makes a stool for himself. Takes some wood, cuts it up, and makes a fire and cooks food over it and feeds himself. And if he's got some wood left over, he hires a craftsman to fashion it. He takes wood and put it on it and then bows himself down to this thing that he's used to serve himself. And he's just, in Isaiah, or God's saying through Isaiah, how foolish this is to bow down to something that you make, that you use for all these other very menial purposes. Okay. So, stay here in Isaiah because we're not done. He had used Assyria then to punish his people. Now we come down and we ask this question. And this is a question that people ask when they come to the Old Testament. Primarily liberals, but I've run into evangelical Christians that struggle with this question. How could God justify punishing Assyria at this time? Now yesterday, I was listening to I listened to a short interview with, does anybody know who Penn and Teller are? Penn and Teller. They are magicians, very famous magicians. Penn's kind of a big guy, and he's the one that does all the talk, and Teller is his sidekick that's silent. He never talks. That's their shtick. He never talks when they do all this magic. And they're very famous magicians. But Penn is a very open and avowed atheist, okay? And he was raised in a church with a mother, but he turned his back on all this. And I was listening to this interview. This is one thing I honestly have to say about him. I've never heard an atheist say this before. The only good thing I think I could ever say about an atheist, and that is he says, I actually respect Christians that really respect what they believe. I don't think you ought to outlaw Christianity, because he says, I think if people want to worship God, I think it's foolish to do so, but if they want to do so, I think they ought to be free to do that. See? Most people that are atheists are so anti-God, they want it all squashed and totally removed out of the public. And I've actually heard him say, I think it's stupid to outlaw talk of God in the public forum, because he says that's squelching freedom of speech. And he says, how open-minded can you say you are if you say people can't talk about that? He's one of the few people that actually has at least got enough brains to realize the inconsistencies of the position they usually take. But anyway, the guy's still lost and he's an atheist. But having said that, they were talking yesterday about, you know, what would you do if a person went and picked up a gun and shot a bunch of people and said God told him to do that? And certainly people have done that. Muslims do that, but there are people that claim to be Christians that have done the same thing. And I'm sure people from other religions that have claimed that their God told them. And this guy asked him this question. He says, I think it was kind of crazy. If you read the Bible, because this guy grew up in a church, went to Sunday school. He says, God sure charged people to go and commit a lot of atrocities in his name throughout the Old Testament. See, that's what they call those things. They look at the Old Testament and they see those things as atrocities. Now, we already, in Hosea, we've already kind of looked at these people, the Phoenicians and these people that lived in this area. And remember, what was one of the things that they did commonly in Baal worship? Yeah. Now, modern religion people, if you go and take modern religion classes at a secular university, they're going to try to say, oh, no, we're not reading their documents right. Because they don't want to admit that there was child sacrifice, because that makes that look pretty bad. And then I actually read an article this last year where they were trying to say that there was no child sacrifice or very little in Baal worship. And there was actually a large segment of Jews that were worshiping the Jehovah or Yahweh, they call him, of the Old Testament, that they were committing child sacrifice to Yahweh. And I was like, that wasn't to Yahweh, it was to Baal. It's like, the guy can't even read his own Bible. They weren't doing it to Yahweh. And then I read on and he says, because they had substituted Baal for Yahweh. They were saying Baal and Yahweh were the same God, which is one of the stupid things that they did. But God never asked them to do that, see? It was actually something that God seriously punished them for. Okay. So they look at these as atrocities. So I want to answer this question here. How is it that God could take this rough, cruel nation of Syria, use them to punish Israel and Judah, and then turn around and punish them for doing what he wanted them to do? And we're going to look at one example right here in Isaiah. Isaiah 10. Notice what he says. Verse 7. Now this is after, well, let's go back to verse 5 and read this. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in whose hands is my indignation. I sent it against a godless nation, and commission it against the people of my fury to capture booty, to seize plunder, to trample them down like the mud in the streets. Now here's the question. God did all that. Did Assyria do that because they knew God wanted them to go take care of Israel and Judah? No, because that's actually what verse 7 says. Yet it did not so intend, or that was not what it likened it to, is the idea of this Hebrew word. In other words, if you would have asked Assyria, are you doing the will of God? No, in their purpose, they were against the God of Israel. So even though they're doing the will of God, verse 7 is telling you, that was never their plan to do the will of God. In fact, nor does it plan so in its heart. Rather, it is its purpose to destroy and to cut off nations. So, number one, we'd look at this and we'd say, Assyria never intended to do the will of God. They never intended to do the will of God, number one. Number two, when they did do these things that God wanted, even though they're not doing it knowingly that it is God's will, they're ignorant that it's what God wants them to do, God then tells them in verse 12, and it will be that when the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, that he says, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria. So he's looking at the king of Assyria and he says, he's arrogant. Literally that word arrogant is he has a big heart. That is, he makes his heart great. I'm a great one. That's his arrogance. He's great in his heart. He thinks he's somebody great. What does he do here? For he has said, by the power of my hand, and by my wisdom I did this, for I have understanding, and I remove the boundaries of peoples. Okay. Keep your finger here for just a minute. Flip over to Acts 17. He took credit for what God does. Look over here in Acts 17, just as an example. Because this is a very, very plain statement, which is why I kind of like this statement right here. Daniel has a number of these in Daniel 4. But Daniel 17:26, it says, and he made from one every nation of... Acts 17, I'm sorry.
What do we have?
Acts 17:26. Sorry. Daniel has this in Daniel 4, but we're not in Daniel. So Acts 17:26, and he made, that's talking about God, this is Paul speaking, from one... every nation of mankind to live in the face. And is that true? Did we all come from one?
Yeah.
Now that's important because, see, the Greeks didn't believe that. The Greeks actually believed that they were descended not from the same creation of a god that other nations were. They believed that they were actually made a superior creation.
The Greeks did.
The Greeks did. So this is very interesting. The Greeks did not believe that they were descended all from the same lineage of mankind, that they didn't believe they had a common ancestor. But if we know Adam, or even better, Noah, because we all go back to Noah, we have common ancestor. So he made them all to live on the face of the earth, having, notice this, determined, first of all, their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. We've talked about this verse before. When our nation came into existence, in the 1700s, it wasn't an accident. God had, in his plan, ordained that our nation would be then, would come into existence then. Okay? Now, the other thing he's done, and he's fixed the boundaries of their habitation. Our country came into existence because of something that was going on in Europe that was called, remember your America or your world history? Colonialism. Colonialism was where you extended the boundaries of your nation by establishing colonies in other places. And that's really kind of a big part of how our country got started. It was a system of colonies under England. That's how it got started. But God set the boundaries. And you know what? God limited those boundaries so that eventually England, those boundaries were knocked back. Thus, our country came into existence. And then there were parts of our country that were owned by France. They were within the boundaries of France. That was partly war and partly purchase. And some of it was Spain, and some of that was war, and some of that was... So there were a number of ways, but the boundaries. So whenever you look at boundaries that shift and nations that come into existence and the nations that end and changes, always keep in mind, all of that, if you could go to heaven and God would actually take in his library, and I don't know that he has a library like this, but we know he keeps books, he'd be able to show you this and you'd go, look at that. You wrote that down. And if he'd let you peek ahead, you'd be able to see what nations are going to go out of existence in the coming year, perhaps, and what ones will come into existence, if that's the case. So God's the one that does this. I know. But that's what I'm saying. If he would let you. That's right. But it's not... it's not for us to do that. But in Isaiah 10, who took credit for establishing boundaries? The king of Assyria. I did this. I always think of another arrogant king that God gives the same revelation to. Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 4. Because what does Nebuchadnezzar do? He comes outside and he says, look at all this great kingdom that I have established. All this that I have done.
doesn't give God any of the glory. I have done it. And God turns Nebuchadnezzar into a wild beast for 7 years. Okay. So, until he learns that God's really the one that rules. You know, I'm not kidding. I still kind of get myself a little bit, my nose bent out of shape with politics and stuff once in a while, but doesn't it just kind of lift the load off your shoulders the more and more you come to appreciate the fact that God really, he really is in control? I mean, we say that. We go around and say, God's in control, but a lot of Christians say it, but I don't think we really believe it.
So we got to buy into the age.
That's right. We can buy into age. The age goes on and things change and things come and the things we liked are gone and maybe a better thing comes along and... But whatever it does, it's up and down. And we just ride it out because we know God's ultimately in control. It's a really comforting thing when you come to understand and appreciate that. Instead of being with these guys that, you know, they're all thinking that they're going to control this, set the boundaries. So we have first of all, Assyria didn't intend to do the will of God. Second of all, we have a king that was arrogant, and I would say not just arrogant, but verse 15. He's like an axe that boasts against the one that wields it, or a saw that exalts itself over the one that uses it to saw. And every one of us has used a tool to do something. We've used a knife. We've used a knife to cut meat. We've used an axe to chop wood or a saw to cut a piece of wood or something. We've all used a tool to do something. And you've never once sat down. Most of us do not know what nice handwriting is anymore. I think beautiful handwriting is going the way of my grandparents and my mother. I used to love getting letters from my grandmother. I wrote to both my grandmothers for years and years after we moved out here. Peg's mom would write us letters, and they all had just beautiful handwriting. They would write, and just it was flowing. It wasn't fun to... In fact, we just came across a letter recently in a book that my grandmother wrote us just before we moved out here, and I was reading through it, and I just admire that handwriting. You don't see that anymore. But you know, why does that person have handwriting? Because they've got an excellent pen, that pen did it! No, it's because a person actually learned. You can get the same pen to 20 people. And they can all make an absolute mess and they can butcher their handwriting so bad that nobody can read their scrawl. You know, that's Tim's case. So, I just gave three reasons. I gave three reasons here that because I think there are three. The third one is the axe boasts against the one who wields it. Or put it this way, the tool boasts against the one who uses it.
Doesn't that kind of go to the second one, to credit for what God did?
Well, it says he was arrogant is what it actually said up in there, is that he had an arrogant heart. So I suppose you could say they're the same thing. They're just further explanations. Okay, now, I'm going to do one other thing, and I don't think I'm going to go through all these verses. I gave you a whole slew of verses down here on the bottom. I want to look at a few of these, and I want to kind of tie these together with just a simple explanation of how can we explain God's use of evil men or nations to accomplish his purpose. In other words, does God force them to do evil? In fact, wouldn't you say when you get done, even just reading this context of Isaiah 10, that in reality what God does is God lets them do what they want to do the most? Well, why don't they do that all the time? Because God's got a boundary set. Up until God wanted Assyria to take Israel away, God had a boundary. And the Assyrian king, they could make incursions against Israel. They could be a real pain in the neck. But they could never take Israel away until God removed or allowed them to extend that boundary.
Was there a battle where they came and God took them all out by himself?
Yeah. That's what we're going to get. And that's a part of this study. But we're not going to get to it tonight. Okay, we're going to save that for next week. But I want to look at some of these scriptures down at the bottom and flip over to Deuteronomy chapter 28. I just want to read some of these passages over here. I can't remember what the author's name is. I read the book two or three years ago when we were talking about the will of God and God's sovereign plan. And I was reading this book. It's called God's... Oh, Bruce Ware is his name. And I've listened to some other stuff, and I wouldn't say everything he says is great. But it was a book, really, where he's trying, for the most part, really to give credit to God and his sovereignty in things and trying to demonstrate, really, that God is sovereign. But showing that God's sovereignty works in what we would call a compatibilistic mode with man's free will. That is, God keeps man from exercising his free will in certain degrees by just putting limitations that man can want to do. You could want to do something all day long. I might want to go out tomorrow and run a marathon, but I tell you, no matter how I try, it's not going to happen. There are just some limitations. One of them being that I'm a little overweight, or a lot overweight, and that I'm just not in the condition to run 26 point some miles. It's just not going to happen. See? So there are limitations. Okay. But in reality, a lot of what God accomplishes in his sovereignty, and he's the one who came up with this phrase, and just giving him credit, was that God uses these people to do what they want to do most. That's really what's happening. And I think what we looked at over there in Isaiah really agrees with that. So Deuteronomy 28, look at Deuteronomy 28, begin with verse 25. It says, "The Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You shall go out one way against them, but you shall flee seven ways before them. And you shall be an example of terror to all the kingdoms of the earth. And your carcasses shall be food to all birds of the sky, to the beasts of the earth, and there shall be no one to frighten them away." Look down at verse 36. "The Lord will bring you and your king, whom you shall set over you." So he's looking at a time in the future when they're going to have a king. "To a nation which neither you nor your fathers have known, and there you shall serve other gods, wood and stone, and you shall become a whore, a proverb, and a taunt among all the people where the Lord will drive you. You shall bring out much seed to the field, but you shall gather in little, for the locust shall consume it." Let's see, 47. It says, "Because you did not serve the Lord your God with joy and a glad heart, but the abundance of all things, or for the abundance of all things, therefore you shall serve your enemies, whom the Lord shall send against you in hunger and thirst and nakedness and the lack of all things, and he will put an iron yoke on your neck until he has destroyed you. The Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as an eagle swoops down, a nation whose language you shall not understand, a nation of fierce countenance who shall have no respect for the old, nor show favor to the young." And then I believe verse 63. And it says, "And it shall come about that as the Lord delighted over you to prosper you and multiply you, so the Lord will delight over you to make you perish and destroy you, and you shall be torn from the land where you are entering to possess it. Moreover, the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. And there you shall serve other gods, wood, stone, which you or your fathers have not known. And among those nations you shall find no rest. There shall be no resting place for the sole of your foot. But there the Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing of eyes, and despairing of soul. So your life shall hang in doubt before you, and you shall be in dread night and day, shall have no assurance of your life. In the morning you shall say, 'Oh, that it were evening.' And in the evening you would say, 'Oh, would that it were morning.' Because of the dread of your heart, which you dread, and for the sight of your eyes, which you shall see. And the Lord will bring you back to Egypt in ships by way about which I spoke to you. You will never see it again. And there you shall offer yourselves for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but there shall be no buyer." In other words, as though you're looking to go back into captivity, but you don't have the option of getting back even close to this area. So he says, "I'm going to use these other nations to punish you." Now, in the context, we could also look at the fact that he says, "I'm eventually, while you're out there among those people and you remember God and you seek him, I will come back to you." But I wanted to look, so he's using these other nations because of what they've done. I think we already understand that. Now, I want to go back and I want to look earlier in Exodus at another situation, not a situation in which Israel is particularly rebellious, although remember, when Moses and Aaron go back to the people of Israel, or when Moses shows up to the people of Israel and approaches the people of, or the elders of Israel, do the elders of Israel want Moses to go to Jehovah? Or to Pharaoh, excuse me. No, they don't want him to. They don't want him to. They're not happy But they're afraid he's just going to make things worse. Okay. And so God not only has to get the Egyptians to let them go, but in reality, God's got to get the Egyptians to kick Israel out, which is really kind of what happens as it builds up to that. And so I've got a whole series of verses here starting in Exodus, in which we have statements such as Exodus 7:13. It says, "Yet Pharaoh's heart was hard." Okay? And that word hard, this word katsach, which actually means strong. So when we're talking about hard, we're talking about that he had a strong heart. And remember, what do you do with your heart? You make decisions. You all know people. I'm like this. I'm one man in a house with three women. Okay? And it's been hard sometimes to make, it's hard sometimes to make a decision and say, this is what we're going to do. And they're all going, oh, we don't really want to do that. You know, it's hard to be the bad guy. So sometimes I'm not strong of heart or strong of resolve. I've said, oh, okay, we'll do that. And I go on, maybe.
But
so,
you know why?
What? Yes. So the last two nights I end up getting to watch chick flicks with my wife and daughters because that's what they want about me. So I'd sit down and watch last night and watch a little testosterone ingested movie or something for a while to counter all that estrogen. But anyway, that was our joke last night. But anyway, the point here in Exodus 7:13 is that Pharaoh's heart was hard. In other words, we're talking about heart. We're talking about your resolve, your determination. In other words, Pharaoh was like, oh, okay, go. You know, it's like, no. It's got a strong resolve. Okay, a strong resolve. You know, and you've all met men like that. Once dad's made up his mind, that's it. Dad never budges. You know people like that. Most of you probably, I hope, you knew dads that they'd make up their mind, but they'd also reconsider once in a while. So in 7:14, it says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn." And that word stubborn is actually the word heavy. It's the word that glory comes from, but it's heavy. In other words, his heart's heavy. It's not going to move. Okay. He refuses to let the people go. And then look down in 7:22, we have this little thing with the water turning to blood, and it says, verse 22, "But the magicians of Egypt did the same thing with their secret arts, and Pharaoh's heart was," we got the word, "made strong again," hardened, made strong. "So he did not listen to them." Now, I'm going to keep reading through these until we get to one of the verses that I want to. Chapter 8:32, we have Pharaoh's heart was hard, and then in 9:7, we have the cattle die. And we have the heart of Pharaoh, his strength actually kavod heavy at the end of verse 7, I believe. Trying to find one. I should have marked these off earlier. Well, look down at verse 12 of chapter 9:12. I should tell you what chapter began. This is the plague of boils. And there's others of these. If you look through these, you can see this yourself. But I'm just trying to point one of these out. Verse 11 says, "The magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils, for the boils were in the magicians as well as in all the Egyptians." And then we come to verse 12, "And the Lord then hardened or made strong Pharaoh's heart." Now, some people look at this and they say, how do you blame Pharaoh for this? Well, what we've been seeing is Pharaoh has, his heart has been made strong. He either has made it strong himself or it's been made strong by seeing the signs that his magicians did. But here's a time where Pharaoh is starting to weaken because of he's got boils all over. Everybody's got boils. They're miserable. If you've ever had a boil, I had a boil once. It's miserable. Okay? And I can't imagine being covered with boils like these people were. And you could imagine if you were in a lot of pain, it would be hard to maintain your resolve, your will. And so that Pharaoh started to weaken. Now, does Pharaoh want to weaken? No. Evidence to the contrary up to this point. Pharaoh has no interest in letting him go. But man, he's hurting right now, and so he's a little weak of will. So what does God do? God strengthens Pharaoh's heart. And he did not listen to them. And you're going to have that throughout here. In other words, God is not forcing Pharaoh to do anything other than what Pharaoh wants. He's just giving Pharaoh strength to hold out his resolve to do what he wants to do in this situation. He's keeping Pharaoh from becoming weak simply because things are kind of bad at this time. Till eventually, because, and there's reasons for that. Most of you probably are already aware of this or been through that. But why is there 10 plagues that go on? Why did God choose 10 plagues? Because there were a series of 10 Egyptian gods, and God took every one of those on. Every plague is aimed specifically at one of the Egyptian gods until he gets down to the very end, and he actually has the plague that actually takes the life of the firstborn of everything in Egypt. And it's with that that God has shown his superiority to the gods of the Egyptians. But he has to do that. It's not just for the Egyptians. Who else is it necessary for? For Israel. Because what was Israel doing when they were in Egypt? They were worshiping some of the gods of the Egyptians. And God has to say, what do you want to mess around with these guys? I've taken every one of them on. And so it's necessary for God to give. When we talk about the heart, it's okay to say that he strengthened his heart. Just understanding when you're saying that, you're talking about that he strengthened his resolve within his heart. He's strengthening that part where he's going to make a decision. Now, the reason we look at this is we come down to this and we can say, how does God use these nations? Well, he uses them to do what they want to do most by allowing them to do that. And at times, as in the case with these guys, by actually strengthening their resolve and their will. We could have other verses that actually, God says, he actually puts a hook in the mouth of some of the enemies of Israel and actually drags them off. In other words, he's actually the one that kind of throws the thought out there. Hey, did you look at Israel? Oh, look at them over there. And what do they want to do? They want to attack them. They just need a call to their attention. And so God brings them off to do that. But in the end, it's not that God is in any way, in reality, forcing these people to do any more than they want to do with their own broken, sinful natures. I shouldn't say broken. Corrupt, sinful natures. Okay. And that's an important thing to understand when you come to these prophecies, especially this prophecy that's going to be all against this nation, but it's against the nation God has used to accomplish his purposes. Against Israel, as well as against Judah. Okay. Any questions as we close? Okay. We'll come back next week. We'll move on a little bit more through this. Next week we'll actually kind of get into a little bit more of the main part of what's going on in the book of Nahum. Let's have a word of prayer. Our Father, we're thankful for the evening and for your word and for the encouragement it is for us as believers to learn not only what it is just to say that you are in control, but to actually observe it as we open your word and see in history how you have actually controlled the distances to which nations can go and have used nations with their will that is contrary to you to accomplish your purpose with your people Israel. And we're thankful that we can look at this, and it does cause us to have an encouragement as we look at a world sometimes that's around us, and it's sometimes wondering why certain people are in authority, why certain things happen, why certain injustices go unpunished, and realizing that they don't go unpunished, that they're serving a purpose in the meantime. And there is a time coming in which you will make things right and you will bring about justice. And we look forward to that time that we get to observe it. We don't bring it about. It's not our job to bring it about. And we look forward to seeing you do it. We thank you for it. Amen.